This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Helen with you on today's episode of Afternoons. Ahead of International Women's Day, bringing together an all-star cast from Sage Clinics as we address body image, mum guilt and more, taking your questions and addressing some of the common issues that are coming up in clinic, and meeting an absolute superwoman as well, Joyce Azam, incredible athlete. She has completed the Seven Summits Challenge, including Everest. She reckons motherhood is harder, hearing her story. Dr. Salman speaking to us from Moorfields around glaucoma, and a doctor of a different kind, Dr. Joanna Porto, speaking to us for Pets and Vets, as we had a bit of a deep dive into our senior animals, supplementation, diet, and of course, answering your questions too. We're having something of a round table ahead of a special event that's happening for International Women's Day, Sage Clinics, tomorrow morning. We'll be telling you more about that. But we are picking the brains of some of the best in the business across a whole range of disciplines. And I read a poem earlier today and I just wanted to read it out because it really speaks to what we're talking about today. You are not just anything, not just a woman or just a friend, a wife, a partner or just a mother. You are a universe made up of waves that brought life, stars that hold up dreams, landscapes of home, rocks that will crumble but always remain. The wind's gentle sway, the strongest roar. You are someone's all. And all is not lost. You are a mother, but never just. Jessica Ulrich, really lovely poet. And I just thought it really speaks to what we're talking about today in terms of identity and just how much that can be rocked and somewhat undermined when you become a mother. And we can talk about identity, about body image more. The Sage Clinic team are here. And I'm delighted to introduce you to Dr. Gervin Ranger, clinical psychologist. We've got psychologist Huba Salim and Hala El Shafi is here, consultant dietitian as well. Thank you all for spending time in my company today. And I've got questions already coming in and actually speaking to many of your interests. But before we go to the text line or indeed some of the topics you're going to be tackling on the show tomorrow, I wondered if I could go around to each of you and just ask the most common concerns that women in Dubai are coming to you with. So, Dr. Gervin, what comes to mind, you think, what are Dubai women struggling with?
I would say, I guess from my clinical practice, one of the most common things that come up is exactly what you just said. It's identity, juggling multiple things, expectations, maybe restrictions or limitations that are trying to kind of break, what's the word, expectations, or, you know, do things in a slightly different way than perhaps generations previously.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And identity within relationships as well, I would say, is something that commonly comes across.
We can definitely talk about where some of these expectations come from this hour as well. Hala, consultant dietitian, tell us a little bit about some of the issues that you're facing and think, gosh, that's an interesting pattern, because maybe we can help lots of people today.
Yeah, so I sit within the eating disorder service, but also deal with women that have issues around body image, but also disordered eating. So it wouldn't necessarily be diagnosed as an eating disorder. But the core commonality is really poor self-esteem. And I think that's the crux of their recovery, in actual fact. So a lot of the work we do, you know, it's not actually about the food. It's about everything else. So yes, I would say that.
That's interesting. You were nodding there along about self-esteem. Is this something that is resonating with you and the clients that you're seeing in clinic?
Absolutely. To just, you know, add to what Gervin said and what Hala said, it's a lot about this concept of being enough, right? Mm-hmm. Am I good enough as a mother? Am I good enough as a wife? Am I good enough if I'm working? Am I good enough if I'm not? It's this constant duality, you know, it's this constant like existential crisis of what am I supposed to be doing? And it's this supposed to and this should that's constantly like haunting women, you know, about these roles that we're supposed to be playing.
And like, feeling torn.
Absolutely.
Constantly feeling torn.
Absolutely. You're in the home, you feel you should be out, you're out, you should be in.
Feeling like you're not, I mean, I feel like I'm getting free therapy, feeling like you're not doing a good job anywhere.
Right.
Okay, it's good to know we're not alone on this, guys. We are going to be tackling a whole range of topics between now and 4 o'clock. So if you've got any questions for any of our three experts joining us from Sage Clinics, do reach out. We've given you a small sample of really what is coming into clinic there and what we can address. We've had a message here from Annie saying, how on earth do you cultivate a positive body image? I'd love to hear your tips on learning to be okay with changes to your weight and shape. How can I learn to love or even just accept my body and be comfortable in my skin? Annie will be addressing that this hour. Joining us now, something of a round table ahead of International Women's Day, we have got from Sage Clinics, Dr. Gavin Ranger, clinical psychologist. Hiba Salim is with us, psychologist, and Hala El Shafi is consultant dietitian. We're going to be trying to address as many issues as possible ahead of an event they're having tomorrow. And it's really interesting, the messages we've had so far, because I think it really speaks to some of the very common, very normal concerns that we don't, sometimes we can't even talk to our closest friends, you know, or even ourselves about this. And Annie's been in touch saying to your guests, how on earth can you cultivate a positive body image? I'd love to hear your tips on learning to be okay with changes to your weight and shape after having a baby. How can I learn to love or even just accept my body and be comfortable in my skin? I think Annie's speaking the words that an awful lot of women probably struggle with all the time. And, you know, Hala, maybe a good question for you. You were talking earlier about, obviously, you help from the dietitian front, but it's the emotional side of how we feel about our bodies and what we put into them, how we nourish ourselves, that's so crucial. Would you mind speaking to that and your advice?
Yeah, absolutely, Helen. So the question is actually a question that we hear all of the time, you know, and I think the one thing I would like to say is that so many women feel like this, right? And some men too, but it's International Women's Day coming up. But so the focus is around that. But that's the one area that I wish that every single woman could turn around, because it impacts everything else in terms of what you think impacts how you feel, which then impacts how you act. And that's when we can have disordered eating behaviours, an unhealthy relationship with exercise, and a number of other, you know, mental health issues that actually transcend from just the way that you think. Now, we live in a really toxic environment, yeah? From the conversations in the office to what you see on social media, on the news, on, you know, you just drive down the Sheikh Zayed Road. If you felt good about yourself at the top of the road, you're not going to feel that great about yourself at the bottom.
Well, it's interesting because when, you know, when I was a teenager, you would compare yourself to the other kind of girls in your year and maybe the odd, you know, person on the cover of Just 17. And now it's the constant bombardment.
Exactly.
Do you think any or many women are actually truly happy and comfortable in their skin?
Well, I wouldn't like to give a definite, but I would say from my experience, this is the commonality. And it's not just the people that are coming into clinic. I hear it 24/7, right? And the issue with this is the lack of self-esteem is so pervasive, and it's just bubbling under.
And it can have a role, presumably, sorry to jump in.
No, please do.
Obviously, you're talking there about exercise and eating behaviours, but also, you know, how you might be with your partner,
yes,
how confident you are to put yourself forward for a job promotion. About one, I mean, speaking personally, one big thing I was really worried about having daughters was like passing my own body image issues onto them. Although I have to say, my daughter was teasing my husband the day about his hair, and he was like, oh, well, you perfect. She's like, I love everything about my body. And I was like, long may that continue, please. Hiba, would you mind speaking from a psychology point of view in terms of actionable strategies for being, I mean, it's a beautiful dream for every woman to wake up and be like, I am beautiful, look at my body. There are 50 things I love about my body. But for some women, to stand in front of a mirror can be deeply distressing.
Absolutely. So coming back to the question, to part of the question, and then we'll continue to women in general. But part of that question was like after babies. And I think this is a lot of what we see in a lot of life-changing situations. We expect to go into that tunnel and then come out of that tunnel exactly where we went into it. And
just that's for the baby.
That's not going to happen.
No.
You had a baby, right? So it's just like, we want to admit that those 9 months, the transformations that our body went through, and we want to go back to point zero. Mm-hmm. That's not going to happen, right? And part of it is accepting that our body just went through that journey. It's not, we're not going to be where we used to be. So part of it is letting go of that idea of comparing ourselves where we are today or 9 months into the pregnancy or a year after giving birth or 2 years after giving birth to what we used to be when we were 20. Mm-hmm. That's not going to happen.
And even if you're the same weight, your body shape can be completely different. Things don't fit the same anymore.
It's not about the weight. No. Exactly. It's about how, you know, and the thing is, we're constantly trying to go back to that ideal in our mind. Mm-hmm. And that's forcing us to sort of overlook what works, what looks great, what, you know, what our bodies can do, because we're focusing on what's not working, how my hips are wider, how, you know, my hair has fallen out, versus are we focusing on what's actually there?
I think something that can be really valuable is reminding, and you said it there, like what our bodies can do and right. what they've done, that right. you have grown a baby. Right. You might have fed that baby with your body. You can carry that baby.
Right.
And it is an absolutely mind-blowing thing when you really think about yeah. it. But yeah, when you look down, you're like, oh God, look at the stomach on that. Oh, and you feel, you know, it's really hard. Can I ask then for any practices, resources, does anything come to mind? You're smiling, Hala. I feel like you've got some yeah. things in your toolkit.
Yeah, absolutely. Just, you know, in terms of what you just said there, the language that we use is absolutely crucial. So obviously what we think, we have to be really mindful about what we think and how we think, but also what we're saying about ourselves. Now, if our whole value system is based on how we look, this is going to be a really bumpy ride mm-hmm. because in actual fact, you know, what about who you are as a person? What about, you know, your value system in life and in society? You know, if you're putting yourself in a really tricky place, if your worth is based on how you look and your aesthetic, mm-hmm. you know, we as women need to do much better than that.
If you've got any questions for the team, please reach out 4001. We have, as I thought and had hoped we would, have a message about mum guilt. It is pervasive, but we're going to be tackling that next. This is ahead of International Women's Day event that's happening tomorrow at Dubai Ladies Club with Sage Clinic's team. Now, you do need to register if you want to send me the word event. I'll send you the link so you can check out more. You're going to have to be quick, though. It is an expansion of what we're talking about today, but we're having a mini workshop today, a mini roundtable. We are talking identity, body image and more with the team from Sage Clinics ahead of a free event they're holding for women tomorrow at Dubai Ladies Club. If you want details of that event, you're going to have to be quick. It's already almost full. Joining us in studio, we've got Hala Al-Shafi, consultant dietitian. Hiba Salam is with us, psychologist, and Dr. Gavin Ranger, clinical psychologist. So a real kind of Avengers Assemble for taking my questions, but honestly, most importantly, yours that are coming in on 4001. I thought mum guilt was going to come up because it's something that every mum, and to an extent dads, but not to the same extent, are struggling with. But this message has come in, and I want to put it to you, Dr. Gavin, because it sounds like it's kind of beyond what might be the normal struggles, especially, you know, kind of from a working point of view. So anonymous message is saying, I've got a chronic disease that COVID has made worse, struggling with the mum guilt, and I'm starting to despair that I'll ever get better. There's been financial loss, a loss of identity, I can cope with that, but it's the loss of the mum I was and the impact on my family that's the real struggle. No other woman could love me like I do, but deep down, I think they could be better off with a different mother. I'm feeling really stuck. Blessed with an amazing husband, but I feel like it's unfair. I can't see the wood for the trees right now, so any strategies welcome. I mean, I just want to say that sounds like a really, really tough situation. Mm. And, you know, some self-compassion sounds like it's well due, because that's a lot on your plate. If this listener was to come into clinic with you, Dr. Gavin, what are some of the strategies you've been talking about, some of the phrases, words that she could be saying to herself and that you would be saying to her as well?
Yeah, and I guess, you know, it's really tough. And I think two words kind of came to mind. One of those was compassion. The other one was acceptance, but not in the sense of like just accept it and that's how things are now, but more in the sense of like leaning in to what you can do. I kind of often use the quicksand analogy in clinic. So we'll be talking about quicksand, and like the more you struggle to get out of quicksand, the further you sink into it. So actually we want to do the opposite, because if we think about that kind of that mum guilt and things like that,
we're thinking about that to it because we want to be a better mum. Mm. But that struggling against it and that ruminating actually ends up pushing us further from that, because it's easy to get consumed by those thoughts. So the kind of leaning in approach is how we maybe adapt to change. Mm. Because change doesn't necessarily mean worse, it just means different. But, you know, so it's thinking about that and then bringing the compassionate lens in, because, you know, you are more than what you can do physically for your family or your children, right? Mm-hmm. Actually, what children often value is that safe base, that kind of that trust, that support,
the connection.
And so if we're leaning in and extending compassion towards ourselves, then actually what we're doing might look different to before, but it's adapting to, like, different doesn't mean worse. Mm-hmm. And it's actually, okay, what can I do? What's my 100% on the good days, in quotation marks, or the harder days when it comes to, like, chronic pain and things like that? You're still giving 100%, but it just might look different one day to the next.
I think that reframing is really, really interesting.
Absolutely.
And really, thank you, Dr. Kabeen. Can I ask about, well, maybe have a question for you, and you're a parent as well, but do you feel like, as women, this is a really leading question, I'm just going to say it, do you feel like we're really hard on ourselves?
Yes.
Yeah.
The long and short answer is yes, absolutely.
And in terms of where these expectations are coming from, we talked before about the power of saying and really believing I am enough is crucial. Where do you think our expectations are coming from, that we're not good enough in various or indeed all areas of our life, which seems to be a bit of a common theme?
Right. I think it, you know, a lot of it has to do with comparison. And now with social media, it's more prevalent than any other time, right? We're following all these mom blogs, we're following all these mom pages, and it all seems amazing, you know, in those posts.
Don't get me started on the trad wife movement on Instagram right now.
I'm sure. Oof. Right. But these are curated pictures. They're meant to look glossy. They're meant to paint a certain picture, right? So it's important for us to sort of, if we want to be on social media, check out those posts. Let's also check out posts by women and mothers who are honest mm-hmm. about the struggles they're going through. The women who are talking about their kids who are having tantrums and how to resolve these tantrums. You know, the women who are talking about the occasional struggles that they have with their partner, the women who are being raw, mm-hmm. right? But taking these breaks from social media is important. Connecting with women who are like-minded, who support you, having these warrior women around you, that's also important. Having women around you who are tend to be either self-critical or critical of others, that's not going to help. You want women who boost you up, but also boost themselves up. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I always say in sessions, in planes, when they tell you, when they give you the safety instructions and they talk about drop in oxygen pressure, they say, put your own mask on first, then put other people's mask on first. And I think we're all, you know, we tend to try to put other people's masks on first. If we want to start doing things effectively, we need to start with our own mask on first. And it's exactly what Gurveen said, that self-compassion, you know, allowing ourselves to lean into that acceptance, to not having it all be where it needs to be and being okay with that.
I think it was some really, really good takeaways there. I mean, that comparison piece, I think even us, you know, looking around, who are, I would say, pretty media savvy, you know, well-informed, I think we probably all fall victim to this mm-hmm. comparison piece. But what I found really useful is muting some accounts, deleting some accounts, because we kind of forget that actually we've got the power to control and curate mm-hmm. what we absorb. You know, we really do. If there's someone on Instagram that makes you feel like garbage, just unfollow them.
Exactly.
Or mute them if they're a friend. because it, you know, it really, it's insidious. You know, it's these constant, you know, death by a thousand cuts. Like it really does add up. I'm going to talk about identity next, about juggling multiple roles. And we've had a message saying that since going back to work, she was career obsessed and now has lost her oomph. We're going to be addressing that next.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Later this week, it is International Women's Day, and we're having something of a roundtable across many common challenges, issues, but also opportunities facing women in the UAE. Do Joining us in studio from Sage Clinics, we've got Dr. Gavin Ranger, clinical psychologist. Hala El-Shafi is with us today, consultant dietitian and Hibis Salem psychologist. Head of event they are holding tomorrow for free at Dubai Ladies Club. So having a deeper dive into what we're talking about today. We had a number of messages on social and earlier in the show, but I'm going to kind of sum them up with one message. We've only got a few minutes left, but I'm hoping this is something we can speak to, which is about identity, about who am I and how do I feel about work after having a baby? Anonymous listener's been in touch saying she's got a one-year-old, been back at work for 6 months, full-time, busy role. Before her, my life was work. Obsessed with career climbing, that's where my passion is, but my drive for work has just completely diminished. Feeling a bit lost, like I'm not sure of my identity anymore. I hated being at home all the time on mat leave and feel kind of meh about being at work. How can I get my oomph back? Going to have a little look around. Does anyone want to speak to this? Go on, Hibba.
First and foremost, I would say check in with your values, right? That's a good place to start. Sometimes we start off somewhere. We think this is what we want to do. This is what we're passionate about. And we just go with the flow. But sometimes it's not really what makes us happy. It's not where we want to be, et cetera, et cetera. So taking a few minutes, taking a bit of time to sort of sit, reflect, you know, think about what are my values? What makes me happy? What do I want my home life to look like? What do I want my work life to look like, right? What makes me happy at work? What drives me at work? It might mean a career change, right? It might mean that you may still want the career, but want it to be more flexible, or you don't want the desk job anymore. You want more of a field job or an active job. But taking a bit of time to sort of assess your values and see what resonates with you, right? What feels valuable for you at the current moment across the different areas of your life, whether it's family, whether it's health, whether it's work and leisure, you know, friends, et cetera, et cetera. That's a good place to start to sort of assess, like, where do I feel the happiest? Where do I feel good about things?
I think it really is undeniable as well, just how much on an actual, like, visceral level you do change when you have a baby.
Absolutely.
You really, and you kind of can't prepare yourself for that. As you said earlier, you know, when we're talking about body image, you think that, you know, 9 months later, you'll just be the same person just with the baby. No, if it was that simple, it's just never that simple. For various reasons, you know, you might be doubting your skills as a mother. You might go back to the workplace and think, I mean, as this listener says, this doesn't really matter anymore. Like, this is, you know, why am I here? How is this a good use of time? Interesting point. This is from a father actually saying, it's amazing you need a license for so many simple things, but when you have a baby, you're suddenly responsible for another human without training. Thank God for mothers and mothers' laws. And it's absolutely true. It's so many things just change, which is why I think, and I've always been a big advocate for talk therapy, you know, or whether it's, you know, something that can be more severe, like your postnatal depression, having someone to speak to who hasn't got an agenda, who hasn't got a bias, whether it's conscious or otherwise, is absolutely crucial. We talk about, you know, building your village, you know, takes a village. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that involves a mental health professional.
Yeah, because I guess it also just on that and kind of following on from what Hibba was saying, if you think about it, you've just introduced a whole new life domain into your life. That's complete uncharted territory. So when you think about the other life domains, which are probably you're a bit more comfortable with, right? Work, health, leisure, other family, like social relationships. So if you've just introduced a whole new life domain into your value system, the other ones are probably going to have to shift in some way. So that
such
kind of
a good point.
Changing those kind of work values, because actually you've just got this whole other new thing.
On the flip side, I would say having a baby made me incredibly efficient and actually really good at my job, because I didn't want to be at work that much.
Yeah.
So I just get stuff done. Guys, you've run out of time, but if anyone does want the information for the event, just send me the word event to 4001. It's tomorrow at Dubai Ladies Club. Hala, Hibba and Gavin, thank you so, so much for your time today. It's been
thank you.
Valuable. Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure. I'm really excited to introduce you to our next guest. Joyce Azam has earned her spot amongst an elite group of athletes that have completed the 7 summits. That's scaling the highest peak on every continent. And she was the first Lebanese woman to achieve this. She's climbed more than 30 mountains around the world, including Everest, Kilimanjaro, Denali, Vincent in Antarctica, and has completed 3 master's degrees and a PhD at the same time. She has also been appointed as a UN Women Goodwill Ambassador for Lebanon last year. She's also a new mum to an 8-week-old, and she reckons motherhood is harder than any summit. Yes.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Well, I mean, my goodness, such incredible accomplishments. I can't even begin to even think where to start with you. But let's start with the climbing.
Yeah.
Where did that start for you? What, was there an idea or an inspiration that thought, yeah, quite fancy climbing one of those absolutely ginormous mountains?
Well, I mean, if you ask Joyce when she was like 15 years old, she would tell you, I would never, ever even dream of climbing a mountain or even hiking. So everything started when I was in my 20s. And I just went on a hike in Lebanon because I was born and lived in Lebanon. And I just like loved the nature part of the hike. It was hard for me. It wasn't easy. Even it was like 5 kilometers hike, very simple one.
Yeah, but ups and downs, if you're not used to it.
Yeah, and it was my first hike. And then along the way, I discovered that I have a syndrome called hypermobility syndrome in my knees, which makes my knees a little bit floppy. They bend backward. They looked really not different when I was younger, before creating, you know, all these muscles in my legs to make that stronger.
So it's really important that you have the muscle to kind of protect the joint and stabilize it.
Yes, okay. Yes, to stabilize it and, you know, like create coordination also in the joint. So, you know, it's not like a disability, but it's something that puts me, like, it doesn't make it easy for me to climb mountains, because when I was 8, I couldn't even run.
Wow.
So
then to think about climbing and, you know, scaling some of, you know, the big ones. What was the first big summit that you did?
So after starting in Lebanon and climbing the highest in Lebanon and discovering that I can do it and training like for 20 hours per day, just, you know, between brackets, before starting with the big ones, I scaled around like 4,000 meters around like between the Alps, because I was studying in Italy. I was doing my PhD in Rome. And, you know, just to, it's very important for me to say that, because for me, it was creating the foundation of the mountaineer inside of me, mentally and physically, and the experience. And then I started in 2012 with Elbrus, which is the highest in Europe.
I was supposed to climb Elbrus and it got cancelled. So it's still kind of on my list.
Yes.
Big time. But it's interesting you mentioned the mental side, because, you know, you can build those quads, you know, you can. You can activate your glutes, you know, you can. But in terms of mental toughness, how did you start to, I mean, David Goggins talks about callousing the brain, you know, really becoming mentally tough when things get hard on a mountain, and my goodness, they can. How did that develop over time, and were there any moments where that mental toughness was really challenged?
Yeah, for my mental toughness, I started small. So I started with a consistent climbing mountains from, you know, the small mountain to the bigger. I, you know, scaled the stairs step by step. And then it's about the daily training of the mental strength. So these days where I didn't want to leave my bed, you know, to go training at 5:30, I had to do it. And this is part of it. And I would go and sit in an ice, you know, 2 or 3 times per week. So this also developed my mental strength, even, you know, it made it grow better. So it doesn't happen in a glance, you know, like it's a strike. It's like boom, and you find yourself on the top of the world. It's really, for me at least, this is my own experience, especially that I have something that, you know, my knees aren't like welcoming me just to run and jump and go down and up, because, you know, it's something I needed to take care of. So it made me go slowly, you know, but surely.
But that's the interesting thing about altitude as well, in terms of that steadiness.
Yes.
You know, on Kilimanjaro, they say like poli poli, you know, slow and steady and acclimatized.
You've climbed Kilimanjaro.
I've climbed Kilimanjaro. Oh! Yeah.
We have a mountaineer in the house.
I don't know. I've got dodgy knees now. I think I'm one and done. Joyce Azam is in the studio today. She is the first Lebanese woman to complete the 7 summits. So Everest.
Yes.
I mean, my gosh, how did that come about? And tell us about the training.
So I left Everest till the end of the 7. So I started in 2012 with Elbrus, and then I went gradually through them. And because I was studying and I was working, so It took me 7 years until 2019. I got the sponsorship for Everest, which is like, you know, plus $100,000. That's what it cost. And I'm very proud that all my seven summits are fully sponsored, you know, and funded. So I played the athlete, you know, the which I love that part of my life. And Everest was 57 days.
Wow.
I had a deeper experience for sure. So the depth of my experience helped me to, you know, take it in mentally, physically, emotionally, psychologically. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of components, like 57 days, you don't have a real shower.
Yeah, no comfort factors.
Although
I've seen some like luxury tents at base camp recently that look absolutely ridiculous. Yeah. But when you are up, when you are summiting.
But when you leave a base camp and in camp two, camp, you know, like you leave 5,400 meters and you go up, it is what it is. You need to sleep in the tent. You need to sleep. I mean, even on base camp, we sleep in a tent. The luxury is a little bit, you know, varies between a camp to, you know, one team to another. But like you can have a little bit of hot water to wash your body. I'm not saying you can't, but you are sleeping on ice at the end every night, you know.
Joyce, is it true that you met your husband on Everest?
Yes. He was on the same team in 2019.
Really?
But then really nothing happened other than, you know, good conversations on Everest. And then we met again in the end of 2020 here in
Well,
in Dubai.
What happened next? We're going to find out next. Joyce Azam with us today. She has earned her spot as an elite group of athletes. She is a goodwill ambassador for the UN. She's climbed more than 30 mountains. She's also mum to an 8-week-old. We're going to talk about mountains and motherhood next. In conversation now with the woman that made hummus at Everest Base Camp, in conversation with Joyce Azam. She has conquered more than 30 mountains and completing the seven summits. That's the highest peak on every continent, the first Lebanese woman to achieve this. You made hummus at Baba Ghanoush and at Base Camp.
God.
I love this.
You went through like my stories or my posts from a long time ago. Wow, I love that.
And you met your husband on the mountain.
Yes, he tried my hummus and my Baba Ghanoush and he said, that's it. She is the one.
She's the one. And then fast forward, just 2 months ago, you gave birth to your baby.
Yeah.
How do you think mental toughness and even the physical side prepared you for pregnancy, birth and motherhood so far, Joyce?
Oh, my God. I mean, I thought I'm super ready. You know, I thought I'm super prepared. I've done, you know, like expeditions on my own, traveling to Antarctica, to Alaska, having 70 kgs around. You know, I would put them on my back and move. And then pregnancy happens and I'm like, oh my God, every mother, you are my hero, Helen. Every mother is my hero. How did you do it? How do you do it? How do you do it every day? I mean, I really, until now, I'm still processing.
Well, it's funny because obviously people, you know, have babies all the time, but it shouldn't diminish just how significant it is on your body and your brain.
Yeah.
Just because you see it all the time, nothing can prepare you. And that's an interesting one. Like, do you wish people had told you about how challenging pregnancy and birth could be, or was it better not to know?
I don't know what to answer to that, because if I knew, maybe I wouldn't do it. And it's a beautiful blessing. I mean, I'm so, so, so grateful and happy, blessed with my baby Marco. But I mean, really, when I looked at it, especially the first 4 weeks when we met at the beach, it was my first time I leave the...
That was the first time?
Yes.
So Joyce and I met on the beach and her friend came over and was like, you guys need to talk. Joyce has climbed Everest and says that motherhood is harder. And I was like, oh my goodness, my spirit animal right here.
And you gave me a big hug that I really, really needed. So I really say to all the mothers that they just gave birth or, you know, they have babies and toddlers, oh my God, you are my heroes and keep going. We are doing this together.
Well, it's interesting because after 3 o'clock today, we're talking about this idea of identity after giving birth and a mother's identity. Mm. And it's interesting because obviously your physical achievements are absolutely incredible, not to mention, you know, your master's and your PhD. And then you have a baby. And I'm not talking about you in particular, but, you know, one has a baby and suddenly you're doing something that you've never done before and you're not really prepared for. And that is really, really complicated, I think, identity-wise. It took a long time for me to kind of recalibrate, to be honest.
I'm still processing and understanding, you know. I think it's a long journey mm-hmm. to get to recalibrate and understand how to become, you know, after motherhood. Mm-hmm. I feel it. I feel a big change in my, even how I think about how I do things change, and I'm like, wow, you know, it's a flip in my own life. Yeah.
Are the mountains calling though?
They're gonna always be calling. Mountains, nature, gonna always be part of my life. So before getting pregnant, I was working and training hard to reach the two poles, the North and the South Pole, and my dream is to complete the Explorer's Grand Slam, which is the seven summits plus reaching the two poles and the long distance version, which is 1,000 kilometers on each side of the world, while pulling your own food and equipment, which is around 100 plus kg, 120 actually.
Wow.
So, yeah, I was like pulling tires and moving, like doing trainings for 20 days, 300 kilometers in the Lebanese mountains, and coming here to the empty quarter and pushing tires on sand. I mean, I really had big muscles, and then, you know, life took me to another.
And now you're carrying about, what, 5 kilos?
Yeah. And I remember when the baby was born, I had a big baby, and my husband was like, oh my God, you are carrying this baby? Like, yeah. He's very heavy, and all the time, and moving, climbing stairs, because I had a lot of muscles, you know, before getting pregnant.
You are my hero. I feel like, you know, every mountain kind of teaches us a lesson. It really, really does. But yeah. I mean, there's no lesson like parenthood. There really isn't, to understand who you are at your core and what you're truly capable of.
100%. And now, before having the baby and even while pregnant, I had ideas, you know, that they are unrealistic. You know, we don't know what we don't know.
Uh-huh. So we're all the best parents until we have a baby.
Yeah. 100%. And you also, I want to also apologize for all the criticism for other parents. It's like, wow, you know, like, It's hard, man. It's really hard.
Joyce, it's such an honor to meet you, to know you. For anyone that wants to follow your journeys, what comes next, whether it is, you know, at home with Marco or indeed when the next mountain calls, where can we find you on Instagram?
So I'm Joyce Azam Official on Instagram, and on all the other socials, the same.
Amazing. If you want to send me the word mother, and I will send you Joyce's Instagram, because you are just incredible. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you for having
me. Go
home,
Helen, and give that baby a squeeze.
Yes.
All right. It's amazing.
Your eye health on eye.
With Moorfields Eye Hospital Dubai. World leading experts in eye care. Moorfields. Driven by your vision.
It is your eye health clinic now. We are talking about glaucoma, something that, I'm not going to lie, I know next to nothing about. So we're bringing in the experts now from Moorfields Eye Hospital. Dr. Salman Waka is consultant ophthalmologist in adult glaucoma and cataract surgery as well. We are more than happy to take any questions or concerns that you might have about symptoms, about treatment. Could be to do with your own eye health or perhaps that of someone in the family. Dr. Salman, how are you?
I'm very well, Helen. Thank you very much for having me on your show. And it's a pleasure to be here with you and the team, as always.
Well, thank you for taking time out of your busy clinic. I know how hectic it can get down there. So thank you for sparing half an hour to answer my questions and those that have already come in on the text line for you, Doctor. Now, I want you to pretend that I am, let's say, 9 years old. Can you explain what glaucoma is?
Absolutely. So glaucoma, in its very simplest of forms, is when we have high pressure in our eye, and that can then start to damage the nerve that connects our eye to the brain, which can then result in damage to our field of vision and, in very severe cases, visual loss. So in summary, if the pressure in the eye is high, which starts to damage our vision, this is what is known as glaucoma.
Okay. Again, let's continue with the same line of question and answer and basic level. Why might someone's eye pressure increase?
That's a great question. So in our eye, there's a muscle which makes a fluid, which does so since they were born. And there's a separate part of the eye that drains that fluid away. And it's a balance between the two that maintains a certain value of pressure in our eye. And it's like this since the day we're born, because that's what allows the eye to receive nutrients and maintain its shape as well. So if there's an imbalance between the production or the outflow of fluid, you can end up with an imbalance in the pressure regulation, which then leads to glaucoma. I think that's probably the simplest way to describe it.
So I guess what I want to know is there anything you can do to prevent that?
Well, glaucoma can be genetic in that some people are just predisposed to it, in which case there's nothing you could do to prevent it. However, what's really important is that if you have a family history of glaucoma, then before the age of 40, every 2 years, and after the age of 40, every year, one must go along and have a full eye check with an eye specialist, not just an optician's check, so that if there is glaucoma developing, it's picked up early. And if it's picked up early and treated on time, then no damage will come to the vision. There can be other reasons for glaucoma as well, such as diabetics can develop glaucoma. So maintaining good control of your diabetes is very important. If you're taking steroids for any reason, could be any other indication in the body that you're taking steroids for. Sometimes in about 20% of people, steroid use can put the eye pressure up as well. So if you're taking steroids regularly, just go along and have regular eye checks as well. To make sure that if the pressure is high, it's picked up on time. So essentially, prevention is the key here, and picking up the glaucoma early is the most important thing.
Interesting you mentioned meds there, because we've had a message for you, which we're going to come to in a minute. Anonymous message saying, I was diagnosed with autism a few months ago and then ADHD. I've been diagnosed, prescribed meds. After reading up, I've got really scared because I've got a family history of glaucoma and the meds could cause problems. So I'm going to put that to you, Dr. Salmon, in just a few minutes. We're also going to be talking about, well, advancements in glaucoma treatment and management. It is called the silent thief of sight, but there is light at the end of the tunnel. We're going to be talking about how expert care and indeed treatment can offer up a bit of respite and hope. In conversation now with Dr. Salmon Wacker.
This content is for informational purposes only and does not intend to substitute professional medical advice, diagnosis or treatment.
Your eye health on eye.
With Moorfields Eye Hospital Dubai. Eye care for you and your children. Moorfields, driven by your vision.
And joining us from Moorfields, Dr. Salmon Wacker, consultant ophthalmologist in adult glaucoma and cataract surgery. Now, I emphasise adult there because I wanted to ask, can children get glaucoma?
Absolutely, yes. So children can get glaucoma. Children can be born with glaucoma as well, and it can develop within the first 10 to 15 years of life as well. Although, fortunately, this is rare. Mm-hmm. But if that's the case, then yes, of course, there are special treatments available for childhood glaucoma as well.
Coming back to adult, I wanted to ask you about any warning signs that, you know, listeners, what do we need to be aware of? And is it very much tied to age? You know, my granny had it. I didn't really understand what it was at the time. But the signs and symptoms that we need to be clued into, doctor.
Yeah, so mostly it is related to age. Sort of about 40 onwards is the age at which you might start to develop glaucoma. However, usually there are no symptoms with it, which is why annual eye examinations are just so important to pick it up early and treat it on time. In a few select kind of types of glaucoma where the eye pressure can rise very quickly, very suddenly within a few hours, there might be severe eye pain and severe headaches, nausea, vomiting. But this is also fortunately quite rare, and these symptoms would be hard to miss. But for the vast majority of people, it is, as you rightly said, it is a silent thief of sight. And so the symptoms are not there, which is why it's very important to have regular eye examinations.
Can we talk about latest advancements in treatment and management? And I know you guys, obviously, between the UK and the UAE, very much at the forefront of research and the technology side. Can we offer some hope to anyone who maybe is worried about family history or there is someone in the family who might be struggling with glaucoma?
That's a great question. Thank you. So firstly, the important thing I want to highlight to all your listeners basically is that if glaucoma is picked up early and the eye pressure is controlled in a timely manner, then there will be no damage to vision. So to have glaucoma does not necessarily mean that one would lose their sight. It's only if it's picked up at a very advanced stage when any treatment options are unlikely to bring the vision back. That's when the vision can be damaged permanently. Mm-hmm. So as I've been saying, timely diagnosis is the key to it. And once it's diagnosed, we have a whole host of really easy to administer treatments and advanced treatments available. You can start with eye drops. We have certain special kind of laser treatments available that can be done in a clinic setting. And in cases where, in the few select cases where any of these options are not working, we also have minimally invasive surgical techniques that can help as well. So there is a huge variety of treatment options available. The key is to pick up the condition on time and to intervene on time to prevent visual loss.
Great advice. We've got a couple of messages that have come through for you, Dr. Salmon. You mentioned some medications earlier that you might need to be aware of, and you were talking about diabetic meds as well. This is unrelated. This is so out of my wheelhouse, and I don't even know if you're going to be able to help, but I hope we can. We've had an anonymous message here saying, hi, both. Good timing. I was diagnosed with autism a few months ago and then later ADHD, referred by the same team. I've been prescribed meds in the same meeting. I've read up about them and I've got really scared because I'm in my 50s. There's a family history of glaucoma. The ADHD doctor has given me a few months to think about it, but I just don't know what to do. Could this put me at greater risk? Are there any meds that you need to be aware of that can worsen or even cause glaucoma?
Well, firstly, thank you very much for the question. I would just like to kind of detail the types of glaucoma a bit here. But there are two types of glaucoma. One is known as an open-angle glaucoma, and the other is known as a closed-angle glaucoma. Without going into too much technical detail, the medications that have been mentioned in the question would only increase the risk of glaucoma if there is a risk of closed-angle glaucoma in someone's eye. So I would really recommend coming along to have an eye check, because if we find that your angles are open, as we say, then there is really zero risk with the medications. But if the angles are closed, which is something that we can tell when we do a precise examination, then yes, either some prophylactic treatment needs to be done to prevent the risk of glaucoma, or alternative medications need to be considered. But that's the key message in the answer there.
Okay, well, I have this listener's number, so I will send you Dr. Salmon's details separately off air. Of course, if anyone wants the details of Dr. Salmon, you can just send me the word I or the I emoji, and I will send you the link to his profile and contact details. Last question, which come in from Zubair, saying, is this what you test for with the dye when you have an eye check? So we're talking there about the pressure in your eye, or when someone goes in for one of those regular checkups that you talked about earlier, how is it tested? How is it measured In that moment?
Yes, that's very correctly mentioned, in fact. Yes, so we do use a drop that's a combination of an anesthetic and it's a fluorescent dye, which then allows us to, on our slit lamps, get a very precise measurement of the eye pressure. So absolutely, that's the one. And your listener would have noticed that after the dye, there's a blue light coming from the lamp, which allows that measurement to be taken.
Thank you so much for your time today. You've explained things so well. I'm feeling much more informed than I was half an hour ago. But of course, if this has raised any red flags, any concerns, anyone wants to take any investigations, by all means, just send me the word I or the emoji. I've already had a number coming through on 4001, and I will send you the details for Dr. Salmon Wacker, a consultant, ophthalmic surgeon, and also specialised in adult glaucoma, which we've been talking about today, and also cataract surgery as well. Thank you for your time, sir. I really appreciate it as ever. And I'll come to your office next time. I am due an eye check, so we'll do a location swap. Always an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
This content is for informational purposes only and does not intend to substitute professional medical advice, diagnosis or treatment.
You're listening to Pets and Vets on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
With ProPlan, where the number one ingredient is always high quality salmon, lamb, turkey and chicken.
Joining us live in the studio, Dr. Joanna Porto from Dog Venture HQ, and we've got already a number of messages to Amazing. Be helping out with. It's always busy when you're here. I love it.
That's great. I love that. How are you, Helen?
I'm really well, really well. And I'm really interested in what we're talking about today, because something my mother-in-law said when she was over at Christmas. She's like, when you get a pet, you're really just on a countdown to them getting old. And I was like, wow, that's the spirit.
However, I mean, that's, yeah, overly realistic. But yeah, you don't have to see it that way, right?
I was like,
yeah.
I can't say that. So our dogs are older now, technically, I guess, 7 and 11. So talking about senior animals yeah. today. So I wanted to ask you, in, from a veterinary point of view, what counts as senior?
So obviously senior is going to depend on the breed, right? So if we're talking about a small breed, then that could be as old as 11.
Wow.
If it's a large breed like a Labrador, then at the age 7, they can be considered seniors. But if we're talking about an extremely large breed like a Great Dane, they're seniors by the age of 5. So obviously, the bigger the breed, then they will age quicker. The smaller the breed, they will age slower. So
when you're talking there about that kind of senior cutoff, yep. is that when you would look to switch them over to a senior diet?
So obviously, that would be a great starting point to change the diet. You'd have to consider that they need a bit less protein because they're not as active, so they don't need that muscle buildup. They can also benefit from having a bit less phosphorus to try and pamper the kidneys and try and prevent any renal disease. Vitamin B12 is also very important for gut health. Okay. And then as they get older, we can't forget that the whole body ages, right? The body and the brain. So you have to take that in consideration. So nutrition is fundamental. So choosing a good diet, so get advice from the vet, but choosing a good diet depending on the issue, mm-hmm. right?
See, this is where I find it a bit complicated because our dog is on a renal diet because he's yeah. got a kidney problem and he's old.
Yes. So you can, obviously, you can get the best of both worlds. So obviously, he's on a renal diet to try and keep his kidneys functional and happy. But a good balanced diet should have most of the antioxidants for the brain, good vitamins and minerals as well. If you want, you can add MCT oil for brain health. If you want, I can then talk that through you.
Yeah, I will. I'll talk to you about the specifics. But I've been a little bit worried about his kind of cognitive decline okay. because he started to get super anxious. He's barking a lot more than he used to. Yeah. Seems a bit more erratic. And it's an awful thing to say because I love him dearly, but he's become really annoying.
So that can happen. There are behavioral changes. They can get a bit clingier. They can get separation anxiety. And then they're not so keen on new experiences. They're very happy with their routine. So new people, new pets, they're probably getting a different side of them. So they're not as happy. They're probably a bit grumpy. Mm-hmm. So that could happen as well when there is a certain brain impairment.
Dr. John, you mentioned before about some of the kind of key chemicals, minerals, vitamins that we should be incorporating. Are they going to be in a diet or do we need to think about separate supplementation apart from the oil that you mentioned?
So it will really depend. What is the biggest issue going on with them? Okay. And that's going to be your priority. So in Jarvis's case, the kidneys, right? Yeah. So obviously a renal diet. So you need to make sure that then you find a good renal diet that contains most of the other things. And then, for example, if you want to supplement for the joints, because there's also appearance of osteoarthritis, then you can supplement that. But the important thing is not to over-supplement. I see a lot of my clients asking me, and they want to do what's best for them,
they
right?
They want to biohack their pets.
Yes, exactly. But there's this culture of almost over-supplementing, and that is dangerous okay. because when you've got too much of one thing, then it's bad. It can cause illness when you've got too much. So, and also, if you choose a good diet, it's like us. We are what we eat. So if you're eating well, why are you over-supplementing yourself so much? So it will,
good point.
It will really depend. But you can get the best of both worlds. Check what's the primary issue. If it's a dog with osteoarthritis, then get a mobility diet for them. And then add whatever else you feel it's appropriate.
Guys, if this
keep
is
it simple.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's very easy, much like us.
This is Pets and Vets on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
With ProPlan. Groundbreaking science, life-changing nutrition.
In studio, Dr. Joanna Porto from Dog Venture HQ. We've just been talking about senior animals and we've got a few messages about older pets to come to. But hi to Lillian. Lillian says, hi both. I'm getting myself confused. We're getting a puppy rescue about 4 months old in a few weeks. I need to clarify. I've got a crate and a dog bed in there for crate training, which will be in the kitchen whilst toilet okay. training. Do yep. I also need a dog bed in the lounge for the pup to go to when needed, or will the crate do?
So it will depend, but most people that end up doing crate training, the crate for them is like a safe space. So they actually love it. It's not like, oh, you're detention and go to your crate. No, so they can use it as well, but also there's nothing wrong with having extra beds. lying around the house for them to then nap in different areas. So
what I would say, Lillian, is it sounds like you're not planning on having your dog on the sofa. Please report back within a couple of weeks. Because that was our plan. It was a really lovely idea.
Yeah, I've been there as well. Yeah.
No chance. We get them like like nudging our legs to be like, you haven't left enough space between you.
They win. They always win.
Always win. All the very best, Lynn. Keep us posted. Christina's been in touch saying they've got a Whippet cross. Do you get many Whippets? Do you get many Whippets here?
I've seen a few. Yeah, I love them.
18-month-old Whippet cross called Wendy. Oh, my Wendy days. The Whippet. Love it when you tell me the names. Wendy... Wakeful Wendy has started waking up every 2 hours at night. Sometimes she just needs tucking back into bed. Last night she did a poo, then got up to wee again. She has food at 5 o'clock in the evening, then a half hour walk. She gets let out at midnight for a last wee. She's also got very attention seeking during daytime, jumping on kitchen cupboards, whining. She gets lots of playtime, lots of attention. It doesn't seem to be enough. Hmm. She hasn't left for long periods. There's been no changes to her food. Is this peak teenage behaviour? Or could it be something health-wise? Just want to set some better habits as she gets older.
I understand. I mean, we would have to have a bit more information because maybe she's got separation anxiety. I don't know where she's sleeping, if she's sleeping alone or in the family room, let's say. I don't know how the toilet training is because, yes, she doesn't eat till too late. Mm. So she should have more toilet training at that age, but...
If it's come on suddenly, is that worth it?
If it's come on suddenly, it will really depend. It would be worth going to the vet just to make sure everything's okay. How are the stools? Is there an issue with the urine? Is it a behavioral thing? So, yeah, it's worth going to the vet to check.
Rule out. Okay, hope that helps. We've had questions about cats losing fangs. Love this from Vic saying, looking to take our dog to the dog beach for the first time and we're nervous. 1-year-old retriever, really friendly, still nervous. Any tips for first timers off the lead? Well, my number one advice, after speaking about it on the show before, just be careful if there's any cats there. Last time we went, there were cats on the dog beach. Absolutely. These are pets. People have brought their cats on a lead. Blew my mind.
This is Pets and Vets on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
With ProPlan.
Joining us in studio, Dr. Joanna Porto, speaking to us from, well, she's in the studio, but she is from Dog Venture HQ. I want to go to a really interesting message that we had earlier from Vix, saying we're looking to take our dog to the dog beach for the first time and we're nervous. He's a 1-year-old retriever, is friendly, but still nervous. Any tips for first timers off the lead and in the water? I get those nerves.
That's normal because you can only control your dog, hopefully, but you can't control other dog's behavior, right? So my best advice is just zoom around the area, scan it, see the behavior of other dogs. For that, obviously, it's advisable to know a bit about body language with dogs. But off the leash, I'd probably just walk around on the leash initially, check what dogs are there, if they're friendly or not, and then really see, is it safe? Can I leave them off leash? Probably that would be my best advice to avoid any problems.
I completely agree. If you're talking about the one at Deer Islands, I've only ever been really early, like 7 o'clock in the morning where it hasn't been that
busy. That's a good timing, probably.
Just because I get really anxious and then I'm worried about passing that on to the dogs and da-da-da-da-da. So the first time we went, we didn't let them off the lead at all. And that was fine. They just wanted to have a little snuffle around. I think Jarvis tried to eat a jellyfish and then he had a paddle. And then the second time we went again, it was really quiet. And then we let them off. Our older dog just loves swimming. So it was really nice. Which brings us actually back to senior pets, which is our topic for today, Doctor.
Yeah.
And I guess exercise and older animals as well. And, you know, we sadly said goodbye to our dog a few years ago because she had really bad osteoarthritis and was in a lot of pain. And it became quite a quick cycle, to be honest, from being in pain to not being able to, you know, get in and out of a bed or jump up off the sofa. My husband built her a ramp for some stairs and things.
Yeah.
When we're thinking about exercise and prevention, joint mobility, anything you can speak to there?
So it's sad that it happens so acutely, or when we get signs, it's already quite advanced. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of things that we can do to help them, depending on the severity of the osteoarthritis. We discussed nutrition, but obviously exercise has to be moderate, which means still exercise your dog. Take him to swimming if he likes it. Put him on a joint supplementation with glucosamine, chondroitin, hyaluronic acid. Probably avoid slippery floors in the house. You can always get some padded floors, the ones that you use for little kids, or rugs, carpets. So use that. And then medication-wise, yes, there are a lot of things available. You've got long-term injections of pain medication. So physiotherapy, hydrotherapy, laser. There's quite a lot of things you can do joint health-wise.
Because presumably the temptation is to let them rest, and which can then lead to weight gain, which is then worse for
exactly.
joints.
Exactly. Weight gain is also quite important. So you can't just let them atrophy their muscles and just not move. That's even worse. Okay. They will age even quicker. So that could help. And besides joints, we have to take them to the vets at least twice a year, pay attention to any possible lump that appears, have them checked out. Please, please, please pay attention to their teeth. Oral hygiene is a doorway to health. You're going to avoid a lot of kidney, liver, heart problems by keeping a normal, sane, clean mouth.
So I asked you off air what's been keeping you busy. You did say a lot
yeah,
of dental work.
A lot of dentistry, yes.
So what's, when you say, is this like extreme cases?
What we're seeing more and more is that even younger pets, especially small breeds are prone to having more dental issues.
Why?
Because genetics and the way they chew, or they don't really chew their food, and it the nutrition as well. So it ends up causing a lot of periodontal disease. So it's not just the plaque and the bad smell. There is a hidden periodontal disease that just keeps advancing. And the tricky thing here is they don't show pain. They're wired for survival. So they won't show pain. And so it goes on and on. And that could cause other issues.
Well, we've had human dentists on the show in the past talking about, you know, inflammation in the mouth causing to other issues, you know, even cancers in the body. But as you said, they're kind of the gateway to the body.
Absolutely.
Interesting.
So, yeah, we cannot ignore. A lot of the times we, owners tend to say, oh, he's getting older. That's normal. Yes and no. I mean, have them regular checked. Do a blood test from the age that they are seniors. Don't ignore symptoms. Pay attention to any excessive appetite, reduced appetite, increased water intake, reduced urination. Anything that is unusual, mm-hmm. have that checked out, because you can really increase their lifespan. And I think we all want them to live long, but live well, quality of life.
Totally agree. Speaking of teeth, Jasmine's been in touch saying, our cat has lost a fang. Came downstairs this morning, Bertie yawned, and we saw that he's lost his fang. In fact, this is the second one gone. He doesn't seem to be in pain, although I think he has been in a scrap. The site of the lost tooth isn't inflamed or bleeding. Should I take him to the vet, even though he's not in pain or distressed?
Yes. So once again, the pain question. Yes, so they are in pain, but they will still eat. It takes a lot for them to stop eating. So if he's lost two teeth already, that's either, if it wasn't traumatic, then that literally says you're at end stage dental disease in some or most of the teeth. So absolutely, take it to the vet. Consider checking the rest of the teeth. Have a dental scale and polish. Take x-rays because they're not going to show pain. They're still eating, and that's enough for us to say, he's fine, he's okay. eating. Okay. So, yeah.
Hope that helps, Jasmine and Bertie as well. I guess we don't know how old Bertie is.
Exactly. So that's why trauma, but if he's lost two, then it's not so much traumatic. And regardless of the age, dental disease can occur in younger pets. So he doesn't have to be a very old cat for that to happen, I'm afraid.
Should we be brushing our pets' teeth?
So cats, good luck. You'll probably be better off using other strategies. But dogs that allow you to, and you teach them in a positive way to enjoy it, that obviously comes with a certain technique, patience, time and love, mm-hmm. then you can teach them how to do that and then use appropriate dental treats. There's
okay,
a lot of things.
I was going to say, we're not getting the Colgate out.
Not the Colgate.
What flavors of toothpaste are available?
So to be honest, I mean, I know some manufacturers do flavored ones, but the ones I do recommend are quite plain and boring. It doesn't have to be flavored for them to enjoy it. You can start by doing that with some treats, a bit of peanut butter to get the positive habit going, and then when you replace it with a toothbrush, you can then reward him in the end with a high value treat or something, but it doesn't have to be flavored.
Like a like a nice liver paste.
Lovely.
Dr. Gianna with us. We've been talking about senior pets today, and Si's been in touch saying we've got a dog, Maisie, who is a 12-year-old collie mongrel mix, we think, has kidney disease, but for the last 7 months has been on a renal diet and she's doing really well. She's active, still loves running around, enjoys her toys, not very keen on walks unless it's somewhere new, in which case she is interested, and does sleep a lot more. She has recently starting to eat, and he's put in brackets, clean toilet tissue paper. That's a relief, Si. I've looked it up and it can be a symptom of pica, so P-I-C-A, which is found in humans and animals. This is one like pregnant women are craving, like eating soil or chalk or something.
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, that could be the equivalent. So,
is this a deficiency of zinc? Has Dr. Gianna had any experience of this, and can I give her dog zinc supplements without it being detrimental to her kidney condition?
So usually pica, which is that behavior that leads them to eat unusual things.
So with soil, because we've
soil
we've
litter from the litter tray box,
weird stuff.
Metal, weird things, unusual things. That is not so much due to lack of zinc. That could be a possible anemia going on. And that can happen secondarily to chronic renal disease. So my best advice would be to check the blood test, check if there is any anemia present, and if there is, then address that. But without really knowing what's causing it, even if it could be behavioral pain related or anything else, I would definitely not supplement it with zinc. And once again, if the diet is complete and balanced, you would not need to supplement.
You've got me worried now, because Jarvis has been eating the soil out of the plant pots, and I've just been telling him off. I haven't really been paying attention to if it could be a sign.
Has he only started doing that?
In the last month or so, I'd say.
Okay.
Blood work.
Maybe have just a blood test, just to be on the safe side. It could also be other things. He's only started doing it now.
This is why. See?
Yeah.
I'll pick your brains in a few minutes. But Si, step away from iHerb and the zinc supplements just yet. It sounds like a little bit more investigation is needed. Joining us in studio and taking your questions, and as you're hearing, mine too. So Manal's saying, we're looking for some advice, opinions on what to do with it. We're moving in the next few months. We're moving to a new community. Villa is one of the first to be completed on the development. So there will be building work going on for the next year. Keeping them aside is not an option. Any ideas?
Hi, Manal. So you have to understand that already moving to a different house, that's already quite stressful for a cat. Cats love routine stability. And so that's already a very stressful event, let alone if there's going to be a lot of construction going on and you let them out because they're used to being out. Probably my best advice would be to, yes, keep them inside, but you can probably give them, besides like pheromone sprays, plug diffusers on the walls to try and really calm them down and make them feel very zen. If need be, they can always be on gabapentin, which is an immunomodulating medication for behavior to calm them down a bit. So at least initially on that first phase, while they get settled in, maybe just leave them in one room in the house, and then gradually they can have access to the rest. But yeah, lots of
transition,
lots
period
of pheromone diffusers just to help to calm them down.
Build them a nice catio.
Catio could be also nice.
Go out with a catio.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've run out of time. Dr. Gianna, thank you so much for your time today.
Much.
It's always an absolute pleasure.
Same here.
So thank you. And if people want to give you a follow on Instagram, what's the best place to find you?
Yes, you can find me at DogVentureHQ or follow me on my page on Instagram called @JoannaTheVet. Couldn't
there
be easier.
There you go. And thank you for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, you can subscribe. You'll get direct to your phone as soon as it's out. And you can listen to me live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Monday to Friday between 2 and 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.